Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding Cancer Clinical Trials, What's New? And this is such an important topic, and many of you have asked us to offer a program on this topic. The issue of cancer clinical trials is one that, of course, has advanced the treatment of cancer, and you're going to hear much more about that from all of our expert speakers. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and, indeed, your interest in this topic that we have so many of you on the call today. And we have on the call today over 692 participants on the call from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Bangladesh, from Canada, Germany, Italy, Kenya, Russia, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it really is a credit to you that you have chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program was made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb, Genentech, a member of the Roche Group, and Lilly, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program and also their collaboration, their corporate collaboration in making this program possible. It's a very important topic in the cancer field. It has been historically and continues to be even more so today. Now, we have wonderful speakers, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker for today. And our first speaker is Dr. Edith Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell is president-elect of the American Medical Association. She is clinical professor of medicine and medical oncology, program leader, gastrointestinal oncology, Department of Medical Oncology, director, Center to Eliminate Cancer Disparities, associate director, Diversity Affairs, Sidney Kimmel Cancer Center at Jefferson. Dr. Mitchell has been a longtime presenter on our programs, and she is going to present on an overview of clinical trials, why they are important, and the meaning of informed consent. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Mitchell.
Carolyn, thank you so much for this opportunity. And to the audience, it is a pleasure to speak with you this afternoon regarding cancer clinical trials. And we ask, why even talk about clinical trials? Well, cancer clinical trials are very important. And many, many years ago, it was thought that clinical trials were a last-ditch effort to try and find some kind of treatment for patients. Today, it's very different. Many patients often choose to receive their first chemotherapy treatment or their first cancer treatment in a clinical trial. And these clinical trials don't necessarily have to be all drugs. They could be even diagnostic radiology. For example, there are a number of trials now ongoing for patients with dense breast, looking at other techniques of evaluation since mammography has been determined not to be so effective. So it could be for MRIs or ultrasounds or other diagnostic tools for breast cancer. It could also be for managing symptoms. For example, all of the medications used to treat nausea, vomiting, as well as other side effects of cancer, have been determined by clinical trials. So clinical trials are not just for drugs. Cancer clinical trials may involve other modalities as well. And we say, why do cancer patients take part in a trial? And the reason is the patients may be helped by the treatment that they receive. For some patients in clinical trials, they can receive either the standard of care or there may be a randomization to standard of care plus a new drug or treatment idea. Clinical trials have contributed to the overall knowledge and progress against cancer. Patients are living longer now than ever before with cancer, and in fact, the overall five-year survival of all patients with cancer has improved by 22% over the last two decades. So just in 20 years alone, we have improved. So cancer diagnosis can be quite terrifying, and for patients, therefore, one can ask, well, what do I know about a clinical trial, and what has happened before even the clinical trial starts? Well, first of all, there are a lot of laboratory studies that are done prior to development of a clinical trial. So many scientists, physicians have learned a lot about the entity. And let's say if we are talking about a drug, there are animal studies done, preclinical studies done to know how the drug is absorbed into the body, whether it should be given by mouth or by IV, how long it lasts in the body, and if there have been any unusual side effects that animals receive or experience before the drug is ever given to a human. Prior to the development of a clinical trial, there is what is called the Investigational New Drug Application to the FDA. It's called an IND. So you get scientists from the FDA reviewing the procedure, the technology, or the drug prior to the clinical trial being developed, and there can be input. So there's input at many different levels in the development of a clinical trial, and clinical trials are designed with the overall goal of improving cancer care. The phase one, phase two, phase three studies all have different primary objectives, but the overall goal is to improve the care of cancer patients. So over the years, I'd just like to mention a few advances that have been made by clinical trials. The American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, is the major organization that most of the speakers today belong to. And this organization conducted surveys and evaluations to list the five things that have occurred since its inception in 1964, so about 50 years ago. So ASCO has just had its 50th birthday. And if you think about these, one is chemotherapy cures for Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hodgkin's disease, years ago, while it used to respond to treatment, still most patients died of the disease. In 2014, this study showed that 90% of patients with Hodgkin's disease or Hodgkin's lymphoma, whether they presented with advanced disease or not, 90% or more are cured of the disease. Another is the HPV vaccine that was number two, approved to prevent cervical cancer. Cervical cancer in many cases is caused by a virus, the HPV. And with the vaccine, we're therefore preventing cervical cancer. So this was number two. Number three was a targeted drug for chronic myelogenous leukemia, or CML. And this drug, it's a daily pill called Gleevec. This has cured most patients with CML, but not only CML, it is used for other cancers as well, such as the gastrointestinal stromal tumor. So the production of Gleevec. Number four was curing men with testicular cancer. When I was a fellow in oncology, most patients with testicular cancer died within 6 months of the therapy. And the three-drug regimen, some call it the Einhorn regimen, named for Dr. Einhorn, who discovered it, and he discovered this 1977. It went into clinical trials Now, almost 100% of patients with advanced testicular cancer are cured of the disease. And the fifth was anti-nausea drugs that have improved the quality of life for cancer patients. One of the most notable, Zofran. When treating patients prior to the Zofran era, nausea vomiting was tremendous. And now, with the development of Zofran, other drugs, and combination of drugs, 95% of our patients receiving even the most advanced and most aggressive chemotherapy experience no nausea vomiting. All of these advancements, all five, are considered the greatest advancements for cancer patients in the last 50 years, and every single one was found through carefully designed clinical trials. So clinical trials are very important for the patient, and for each patient participating in a clinical trial, informed consent is obtained, and with informed consent, the patient learns, one, information about the disease process, information about the potential benefits of the treatment, as well as the risk. So a lot of information is gained, and you may ask, well, where do I get information on clinical trials? There's so much on the Internet, and my suggestion is to start with a few common things. Number one, talk to your doctor about clinical trials and get recommendations. And probably the best site for obtaining information on clinical trials is a website called clinicaltrials.gov. The next thing that you can do is find a hospital or center near you that has National Cancer Institute or NCI clinical trials. These are made available throughout the country in many locations so that there is information, there are good clinical trials, and patients can continue to receive the benefit from the clinical trials, know about the clinical trials, and educate themselves as well as their family and their circle of support so that advancements will continue. And it's very important that all areas of medicine are included and that all groups and communities are have the access to clinical trials. So one can ask, start with your physician regarding clinical trials and therefore gain education, expertise, and therefore feel that you have learned all the information that you need to make a decision on your own health care and cancer care. So with this, I'd like to end. And I thank you so much for your attention, and I'll be available to answer questions later.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Mitchell. That was really exquisite and very informative about the whole clinical trial process and particularly to understand about the importance of clinical trials. So I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Lydia Shapira. And Dr. Shapira is Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Staff Oncologist, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is a frequent presenter on our programs, and she is going to address what happens in a clinical trial, how and where clinical trials are conducted, and accessing resources for clinical trials. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you very, very much for the invitation. I will continue to build on the comments made by my colleague, Dr. Mitchell. And my way of thinking about clinical trials is as a partnership between patients and researchers, between patients and clinical researchers and doctors. So everybody, I think, is invested in moving the field forward and creating new options for diagnosis, for prevention, for treatment. Clinical trials refer to a way of studying new treatments, and One way of thinking about it is that today's standard treatments were yesterday's clinical trials. So each one of us can make a contribution to generating more knowledge, and that's really what scientific research is about. One of the concerns that patients often have is how they will be kept safe in a trial. They would like the process to be very transparent. And I think researchers have made an effort, a concerted effort over the last 10 to 15 years to explain to patients better, although we have a way to go, just how we think of trials, why we design them the way they are designed. And we need to remember that each one of us can make a contribution by participating, by accepting some level of risk and responsibility and trying to generate more knowledge so that tomorrow we will have better detection, better treatments, better quality of life, to just keep pushing this because there's so much left to do. Dr. Mitchell talked about the phases of research, the fact that before we ever offer a medication, for instance, to humans, we've already done years of laboratory research. And then once we bring a drug into the clinic and start to think about using it, we need to find the right dose. We need to make sure we know how safe it is. Then we ask ourselves how effective it is. And then we try to ask the question, is this better than the standard treatment? So the amount of work that's required depends a little bit on what the question is that we're asking. The research needs to be designed so that the effort that everybody is putting into it will lead to some knowledge that can be replicated, that can be disseminated. So there are rules. Patients need to fulfill certain criteria called eligibility criteria in order to enter into trials so that we make sure that we're comparing similar things. And the only thing that changes is the new study drug, for instance, or perhaps the new equipment that's tested. Sometimes we don't actually do things to patients. We just want to know more about them. And those kinds of studies involve very little risk. Those are mostly quality of life studies. So almost everybody can participate. Some who perhaps want to use the clinical trial as a form of treatment may be willing to take more risks than others. Clinical trials can be conducted in a doctor's office or at major cancer centers. Usually when we're talking about very new drugs and treatments, those are conducted at major cancer centers with research assistants and more levels of oversight. But many times, research studies are open also in clinical offices and community oncology practices. Clinical trials go through a process of very rigorous statistical design and oversight. And you can be sure that if you participate in a clinical trial that is sponsored by the National Cancer Institute or a reputable body, that in a way what you're doing is you're taking part in something that already has been vetted by experts. Participating in a treatment trial in a way is getting an expert second opinion or an expert global opinion, because it means that a lot of effort has been poured into figuring out exactly how this new treatment or how this new intervention should be looked at and studied. A lot of data is collected, and patients who choose to be treated on a clinical trial usually get scans or some form of monitoring through blood tests every 8 weeks or 12 weeks to make sure that that treatment is actually helping them. And if it's not, then a recommendation is made to withdraw from that study or to be removed from that study. Everybody participates because they want to, so participation is voluntary, and everybody is allowed to withdraw from the study at any time without giving any explanation. So it's hopefully a process that will feel comfortable, that will feel transparent, and that will actually engage the interest of the participant as well. It's a joint enterprise. One can learn about these studies through websites such as Dr. Mitchell mentioned before. Clinicaltrials.gov is one. You just enter the disease you're looking for, and it will tell you the NCI-sponsored studies. But there are many studies these days that are sponsored by industry or are generated through major institutions. So there is nothing like getting an expert opinion of somebody who is actually thinking about this all the time, people whose jobs it is and who are constantly thinking about progress and creating new options. So I would recommend seeking attention from an expert, getting an expert opinion, using these sites just to get an idea of what kind of research is available. I think I will stop right there, Carolyn, and I'll be happy to take questions later on.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Shapiro. That was really wonderful and very helpful and informative to everybody, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Dr. Donald Norfelt. Dr. Norfelt is professor of medicine, Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology, Mayo Clinic, Arizona. And Dr. Norfelt is going to present the benefits and risks of participation, how you can participate in a clinical trial, and the very specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials. Now it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Norfelt.
Thank you for the opportunity to participate in this presentation. I'd like to start by reviewing benefits and risks of participation in clinical trials. The benefits are those that you've largely heard about from my fellow speakers. We are attempting with clinical trials to bring new and improved diagnostic techniques, new and improved treatments, and new and improved supportive care strategies to our patients with cancer. Therefore, when we engage a patient in a clinical trial, we believe that we are offering them the best current ideas and really best current hopes for improved treatments based on all of the scientific background that has been generated to support the strategy being tested in the clinical trial. There's also a larger benefit that you might think of as a social benefit or a community benefit for participation in clinical trials, and that is that the knowledge that we gain from our patients' participation in clinical trials serves to improve the care of many patients in the future who may be challenged with the same types of illnesses. If we can learn and improve our care through clinical trials today, it's going to make our treatments and our ability to help patients in the future that much better. As other speakers have alluded to, this is how we build progressively our knowledge and create new advances in the care of cancer. In terms of the risks of participation in clinical trials, in particular when it comes to treatment trials where new drugs or new treatment strategies are being tested, there is always the possibility that those treatments will not work, that they will not work as well as the scientists had hoped, or in some instances that the experimental treatment actually proves to be more harmful than was anticipated. This is an aspect of clinical trials that is generally discussed very carefully and in great detail with all potential participants. We want patients to be aware that although our best hopes go with these new ideas and new treatment strategies being tested in clinical trials, these are experimental strategies at their core, which means that we haven't learned enough yet about how these things work to deem them to be standard treatments. They are still being studied, and therefore there can be risks that we did not anticipate that only come to light as patients participate in the study. So the risk most prominently would involve unforeseen circumstances that arise during the course of treatment on the trial that occasionally can be harmful to people. Again, that has to be discussed in great detail before a patient makes a decision to participate in a clinical trial or before that treatment actually gets underway. And that relates back to something that was discussed earlier as well, which is the nature of informed consent for participation in clinical trials. Before an individual participates in a clinical trial, it is our obligation, our ethical obligation, to inform that potential participant about all of the benefits and all of the risks that we might foresee in their participation in the clinical trial. And in addition, we have to acknowledge that there may be risks that we cannot foresee and that only come to light during the course of the patient's participation in the trial. In terms of how an individual can participate in a clinical trial, I want to echo what some of my fellow presenters have already mentioned, and that is that at most of the major cancer centers throughout the United States, there is a robust clinical trial process that's going on. That is the reason that our cancer centers exist. And in particular, the National Cancer Institute designated comprehensive cancer centers, of which there are a little over 30 in the United States, are centers of excellence throughout the United States where clinical trials are conducted. And that includes the institutions of all of the speakers today, and the Mayo Clinic is an example. That's where I happen to be engaged in this work. In addition, there are many, many resources available online that can direct patients to potentially worthwhile clinical trials for their participation. The clinicaltrials.gov website, which is maintained by the National Cancer Institute, is a very comprehensive reservoir of information about clinical trials occurring all over the United States. Not only are federally sponsored clinical trials listed in clinicaltrials.gov, but the many, many clinical trial opportunities that are sponsored by pharmaceutical companies will be listed there, and the clinical trials that are sponsored and conducted by individual cancer centers will be listed there as well. So it's a very comprehensive resource, and it should be on the list of favorites on the internet for any patient with cancer who's interested in clinical trial participation. In terms of specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trials, I think it's quite important that patients have some assistance or guidance in this from a trusted source, and that would typically be the physician or nurse practitioner or physician assistant who's been most engaged in their care. It's always, I think, comforting and helpful to get the assistance of somebody who knows the patient's case and knows the patient's condition very well to get that assistance and guidance in direction toward a clinical trial. There are, of course, some circumstances where a clinical trial might be viewed as a bad idea for somebody who's very ill or infirm, and the provider of care who knows that patient well can often be a source of guidance and support and really a reality check for a person's ability to participate in a clinical trial. In addition, that care provider should be a strong advocate for a patient who is seeking a clinical trial, and I would think that most providers in cancer care have a means to investigate on behalf of the patient where a clinical trial opportunity might exist for them. Again, it's that basic knowledge of that patient's background and status that can be very helpful in guiding how a patient approaches opportunities for clinical trials. I think I'll stop at this point and share with my fellow presenters my gratitude for being able to participate in this, and I'm very eager to hear from any listeners about questions that they might have.
Oh, thank you very much, Dr. Northfeld. That was wonderful, and there will definitely be questions for you during the Q&A. I think they're coming in at this point, so thank you all. And our next speaker is Allison Nielsen. Ms. Nielsen is an oncology social worker, and she's our Women's Cancers Program Director at Cancer Care. And Ms. Nielsen is going to address the free psychosocial services and programs that Cancer Care offers, as well as the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Nielsen.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's really a privilege to be on the panel today. Thank you so much for your attention. I'm an oncology social worker who oversees the Women's Cancers Program here at Cancer Care, and I work with many people diagnosed with cancer as well as their loved ones. I'd like to speak about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways in which we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone impacted by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, available face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally, support groups offered face-to-face in New York City and over the telephone or online nationwide, education about resources and navigating the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are offered by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in the ways in which a diagnosis of cancer impacts a person and his or her world. They are experienced in helping people with cancer and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, physical changes, working with the healthcare team, the social adjustment, and psychological impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. During this frightening and overwhelming time, it's important to know what resources are available to help. And even the strongest person cannot handle cancer all by his or herself. The good news is that you do not have to walk this path alone. Reaching out for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of courage and strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others in a similar situation where you can share thoughts, feelings, information, and ideas about dealing with cancer. And individual counseling offers a space that is just yours to voice your concerns and learn new ways to cope with the diagnosis. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. And feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a variety of support group options. We have support groups over the telephone for people diagnosed with various types of cancer and for people who have a loved one with cancer. We call these people caregivers, which is a very all-encompassing term. Caregivers might be providing direct hands-on care each day, or they may not be. But if you have someone in your life that you care about who's dealing with cancer, then you're considered to be a caregiver. We also have online groups for people in treatment who are post-treatment and their loved ones. Those who are coping with cancer in the New York tri-state area can attend our face-to-face inpatient support groups as well. We offer specialized face-to-face groups for young adults with cancer ages 18 to 39. And women who speak Spanish. All groups are facilitated by oncology social workers, which we find is an important way to add to the feeling of the group being safe and staying on track. Other group members in a similar situation can offer valuable insight based on their personal experiences. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please don't hesitate to call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our comprehensive website at cancercare.org. As we've learned a lot from today's program on cancer clinical trials, you might need some assistance in digesting it all. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Know that you're not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you through. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today. Thank you for your attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Allison. That was wonderful. And everyone now does have a resource to call after the call. We're going to be taking questions now, but if for some reason we don't take your question, you think of a question in a day or two, or think of other services that you could access from Cancer Care, please call us at the 1-800-813-HOPE number. And I'll repeat that number again as we get closer to the end of the call. But now we have lots of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board now, and if we could actually if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Once again, to ask a question, please press star then one at this time.
And we have quite a few questions actually online at the moment, and you'll keep me posted about any telephone questions that we have. So one question from Richard is, how easy is it to exit a trial if your disease progresses to a place where it will be more advantageous to you personally to leave the trial? Dr. Northfeld, could you address that?
Sure. Part of the ethical conduct of clinical trials requires that patients remain sort of in control of their fate at all times. And that means that it's perfectly acceptable for a patient to exit a clinical trial at any point that they wish. And there's no penalty, no harm done. We feel very strongly that it's an ethical imperative that patients be given that right and that opportunity. And that's actually a legal requirement as well. So no problem with leaving the clinical trial at any time if a patient feels that it's no longer in their interest.
May I add a little?
Yes, please. Yes.
It's also important that the treating physician maintain communication with the trial if that individual is not in charge of the clinical trial, so that it is always the physician's responsibility to make sure that the patient is getting the best treatment for their condition at any given time. So at any time, if the patient wants to withdraw from a trial, just as my colleague has said, the patient can do so for any reason, but also the patient's physician, if there is disease progression and the treatment is ineffective, the physician may also end the trial or recommend ending the patient's participation. So it is a collective process between the patient and their treating physician, as Dr. Shapira said earlier.
Thank you. Another question from one of our participants. They're asking the question, their perception is that the FDA may be a slowdown at times for a lot of the research. Is there anything we can do as patients to push them to release some of these trials quicker? Dr. Shapira, could you address that?
Oh, gosh, that's such a hard question, because I completely understand the desire on the part of the person who asks the question to, you know, try to figure out how we can speed things up. The problem with speeding things up is sometimes we rush to conclusions before we have sufficient solid data to really support that conclusion. There have been drugs that have been rushed through, and then we've had to backpedal and sort of rescind that approval. So there are processes for expedited approval. And believe me, researchers do take that into consideration. If there looks like there's a very promising drug, they'll try to design the trials that will, in a short period of time, produce sufficient data, perhaps to allow the FDA to hear the results and give a conditional expedited approval. And so I think everybody understands that feeling of urgency. But that said, we have to be very careful to design the studies and to wait until we have the answers, because we may not be doing the public any favors by rushing through drugs before they're really mature and the data is solid. I don't know if my colleagues want to add anything to that.
Oh, I would definitely agree that many times we want the drugs to get to more patients quicker, but we always have to keep in mind that safety determinations take some time to evaluate all of the information and make sure that our recommendations are solid.
Excellent. That's an excellent point. And Now, there's another question about the phases of clinical trials. What are the phases of clinical trials? And Dr. Mitchell, if you would review that with everyone.
Certainly. So I mentioned briefly the phases of clinical trials. The phase one defines a group of clinical trials that are basically designed to determine safety, side effects, and toxicities. So we want to know which patients might tolerate the drugs, how they tolerate the drugs, what are the side effects of the drugs, so that we have a very good idea of drug administration, how should it be administered, what is the dose, and the dose that gives a good clinical benefit, meaning some tumor shrinkage, but also the dose that would give a harmful effect or side effect. For phase two drugs, based on the information that has been learned from phase one studies, we then determine the effectiveness in a given entity so that there may be a phase two trial in breast cancer or a phase two trial of the same drug in prostate cancer. But usually for phase two trials, there are limitations on the disease process, so that it's not given to all patients, whereas phase one studies, for the most part, can be given to patients with any tumor type. But phase two studies usually define the effectiveness of a drug in a given disease state or patient population. For phase three studies, once we have determined the effectiveness of a drug in a single disease or disease entity, then we want to know by a randomized process, is this new treatment better than the standard treatment, or can it be added to standard treatment? And if so, is the new regimen with the addition of this drug to standard treatment, is it better than standard treatment alone? So for phase three studies, for many of the standard treatments that we use now, they have come through and have been evaluated in phase three studies and determined that the standard treatment at that time would be replaced by this new treatment if it's more effective. So phase three studies are designed to evaluate an entity against the standard treatment, and they are usually randomized so that there is equal amounts of patients in both groups, the standard care group and what I call sometimes the standard care plus, meaning the new treatment.
Excellent. Very comprehensive. So that's very helpful for everyone to understand, and thank you for all that detail. Thank you so much. And we have another question from one of our online participants from Adriana. Please let me know your experience reaching Hispanics, Latinos, and what services and organizations offer clinical trial services in Spanish. Dr. Shapira, could you address that question in a general way?
Sure. I think that the most important issue here is the language. And if you have a cancer investigator, a researcher who's bilingual, bicultural, the conversation can flow. I think the problem you bring up is if the patient and the clinician don't speak the same language. In that case, I would strongly recommend having a professional interpreter. Hospitals and cancer centers certainly have them available, either in person or remotely through a phone or video line. Cancer.net, which is ASCO's website for the public, has a section about clinical trials in Spanish. That's available to you. There are many brochures that have been properly translated into Spanish, and if the participant in the trial, also known as the patient, cannot provide consent or read the informed consent form in English, there's usually a generic one-page form that is presented in Spanish, but the understanding is that a meaningful conversation has taken place where the investigator explains it, and with the use of a qualified, certified medical interpreter.
And there are a number of nonprofit organizations in the cancer field that focus on this issue. There is a group called Latinas Contra Cancer, and there is another group, the National Latino Cancer Research Network, and there are many others, and also many other organizations, for example, Cancer Care or Cancer Support Community or American Cancer Society, do have bilingual bicultural staff who can also assist with your questions or helping you to access people who actually are help you to make decisions also about your clinical trials and speak to you in Spanish. So that can be helpful as well. So that, that's an excellent question. And actually, the whole question of diversity in participation in clinical trials, Dr. Mitchell, if you could address that in a general way as well, in terms of just the whole effort to have all people participate in clinical trials, and if you could comment on that.
So thank you very much. It's very important that all individuals who potentially could use a given treatment participate in the clinical trials. For example, there are some differences in individuals based on their ancestors. One of these, for example, in African Americans, G6PD deficiency is seen in about 20% of American black individuals. So African Americans have about a 20% incidence of G6PD deficiency. There are some drugs that are metabolized through this enzyme system, and therefore if there are patients with that deficiency, they could be harmed by the drug. But if we don't have individuals from all communities participating, we won't have information like this so that we can have safety for individuals. So it's very important. Also, there may be disease processes that may be different in diverse communities. For example, triple negative breast cancer is more commonly seen in young women, in African American women, as well as Latino women. So making sure that these individuals have access to and the potential benefit of clinical trials that are designed for patients with triple negative breast cancer would be very important. So making sure that clinical trials are available for diverse populations. And diversity can refer to not only the racial and ethnic background of the participant in a clinical trial, but also the gender, as well as age. There are some drugs that are metabolized differently in women than in men. So again, adequate evaluation of these drugs in women and men, very important. And as our population ages, it's very important to understand how drug metabolized metabolism changes with age, so that an 80-year-old patient might metabolize a drug much differently from that of a 35-year-old. Therefore, it's very important that individuals of all backgrounds, whether the elderly or young, whether it's a racial or ethnic background, whether women or men, all of these are diverse populations, and therefore it's very important that individuals of all of these groups participate in clinical trials, have access to clinical trials, and researchers actually do a very good job of bringing together the appropriate clinical trials for those individuals. So you just have to ask, and if the language that you prefer is not English, let the team know, and it is the obligation of the cancer provider to provide information in the preferred language of the participant.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. So I hope that's helpful to everyone and really really makes it very clear about your access to all, you know, everyone's access to clinical trials and communicating to your team what you need as well. Another question now for Dr. Northfelt. What are the risks or side effects in clinical trials for blood cancer patients? I wonder if you could answer that in a general way, Dr. Northfelt.
Sure. Most patients who have blood cancers are primarily affected by problems with their blood counts. And many of the treatments that are used to treat blood cancers actually affect the blood counts in a bad way. So you take a patient who's already got blood count problems and potentially make that worse with the treatment that's being given to try to overcome the blood count problems. So I would caution patients with blood cancers who are entering into clinical trials to understand that they're going to have their blood counts checked very frequently, and that their transfusion requirements may increase during the time that they're participating in the clinical trial.
Excellent. And another question for you. It's a little bit of a long question, but how does it work on the trials? Is it one team following the phases all the way through from phase one to phase three, or do other teams see what happened in phase one and then take it to phase two? How do the teams doing clinical trials stay in touch with who's doing what? Dr. Northfelt, if you could address that one.
Sure. At different points in the course of a patient's illness, they might be eligible for a phase three or a phase two or a phase one study. I'll say that most phase three trials are comparing a standard therapy with the same standard therapy that's been tweaked in some way. And so there's an attempt being made to push the envelope a bit, but there's a comparison being made to standard care. And so in those kinds of trials, it's most commonly the patient's regular cancer care provider who is taking care of them during that time. When it comes to phase two or phase one studies, very often it's specialized groups within the cancer center, specialized groups of doctors and nurses and support staff who are managing those studies. And that's because there's a little bit a greater potential for risk or harm associated with phase two and especially associated with phase one clinical trials. And for that reason, a different sort of scrutiny is typically applied to how a patient is doing as they're going through those. So there can be a transition at times in the care team when a patient perhaps in the past has the experience of being on a phase three study, but now later in the course of their disease, they're more appropriate for a phase two or a phase one. Nevertheless, for those taking the responsibility of the patient's care at any point in the process, it's really mandatory that care team understand what has gone on before. That may involve a detailed review of the patient's previous medical records. It may and often does involve a very careful discussion between the previous care provider and those who are going to assume the patient's care in the phase two or phase one context. So I think communication is the basic answer to this question, that there has to be good communication between teams of care providers who are taking care of patients in these different phases. I'll just say also that many times a phase one study would only be available at a very specific location away from where the patient had received their prior care. And so then it's even more important that communication happen between the place where the patient is coming from and the team in the phase one location who will be caring for them going forward.
Excellent, thank you. And another question from one of our online participants. If I have found a clinical trial that applies to me, but my doctor is unsure the trial is a good fit, should I get a second opinion? Dr. Shapira, your thoughts about that?
So it's impossible to give an opinion that will satisfy the caller, because a lot depends on what the concerns are. It may be a matter of getting another opinion, absolutely, or it may be a matter, I would say, first, of exploring in more detail why your doctor feels this is not a good match. In some cases, perhaps it's a drug that's similar to something that the patient hasn't received before. Perhaps there's a theoretical concern for toxicity because of the known profile of side effects of the drug. There can be a number of reasons why a doctor says that it may not be a good fit. So I would suggest first exploring it with the doctor, and then if you're not satisfied, consider getting another opinion.
Excellent. Thank you. You know, I want to thank all of our speakers today. You've been exceptional. This has been an amazing call. I also want to thank all of you who've been listening, and those of you who've posted all of your questions online as well. Also, one of you did post a question online as to whether you'll be able to listen to the call again. And these are available on both telephone replay and also as a podcast on our website, which you can download or listen to on our website, so that although the call happens in real time, it is accessible after the call as well. I would give it about 2 hours for all that to go up, 2 or 3 hours, and you should be able to then access the call either same day or early next day. I do want to also acknowledge that this is a one-hour program, and planning a program like this, we do recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so in planning a program like this, we just want you to know that you are now part of getting services from Cancer Care, and I think Allison went over so many of the wonderful services that Cancer Care offers. And we are simply a phone call away, or for those of you internationally on the call, you can visit our website or email us as well. And the services include practical and financial assistance, counseling services, support groups, both on the telephone and online. Also are these workshops that are occurring quite regularly, usually one or two a week. And also, of course, we have publications and fact sheets and, of course, our website. We don't want anyone to feel that you're alone when this call ends, although the call will soon be ending. That does not mean there's services from Cancer Care or your capacity to get continued help. That does not end. And I do want you all to know that you can simply call us at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Again, I want to thank you all very much for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.